Chapter 50. They lay together behind the crest of a dune, staring at the empty tracks that stretched across the sand like ghost rails to oblivion. The only signs of life to pierce the pre-dawn darkness were the distant lights of the Fort Fourreau hazardous waste site. Across the tracks, less than a kilometer west, the black shadow of the abandoned Foreign Legion fort rose against an ivory-black sky like a gloomy castle out of a horror movie. The mad race across the desert had gone smoothly, without detection or mechanical problems. The captives had suffered from the hard springs of the trucks, but were too happy to be free to complain. Fairweather accurately guided them over the ancient camel trail that traveled between the old salt mines at Taudeni south to Timbuktu. He had laid the convoy on the railroad within sight of the fort, using only his knowledge of the terrain and a borrowed compass. Once during their journey, Pitt and Levant had stopped, listening as they detected the engine sounds of an unseen helicopter task force escorted by jet fighters. The aircraft were flying north toward Tabeza and the Algerian border. As Pitt had predicted, the Malian Air Force pilots flew over the convoy, blissfully unaware their quarry was sitting directly below them.
"Fine work, Mr. Fairweather," complimented Levant. "As good a job of navigating as I've ever seen. You put us right on target."
"Instinct," Fairweather smiled. "Pure instinct mixed with a bleedin' bit of luck."
"Better move out across the tracks and into the fort," said Pitt. "We have less than an hour before daylight to hide the vehicles." Like strange creatures of the night, the dune buggy and personnel carriers drove on the track bed, bouncing over the concrete ties, until they came even with the fort. Pitt turned past the wreck of the Renault truck, the same one he and Giardino used for cover when they hopped the train to Fort Fourreau, and came to a stop at the gate. The high wooden doors were still slightly ajar, just as they had left them over a week before. Levant called up a squad of men who pushed them open wide enough to allow the convoy to enter the parade ground.
"If I may suggest, Colonel," Pitt said tactfully, "there's just enough time for a detail of your people to brush away our tire tracks leading from the railroad to the fort. To an inquiring mind, it should look like a convoy of Malian military vehicles rolled out of the desert and then continued along the trackbed into the waste disposal project."
"Sound idea," said Levant. "Make them think it was one of their own patrols."
Pembroke Smythe, tailed by Giardino and Levant's other officers, gathered around their commander for orders.
"Our first priority is to camouflage the trucks and find some sort of shelter for the women and children," said Levant. "Then prepare the fort for attack should the Malians decide they're chasing ghosts, and look for any sign of our tracks the wind hasn't covered."
"When do you plan to withdraw from here, sir?" asked an officer with a Swedish accent.
Levant turned to Pitt.
"How say you, Mr. Pitt?"
"We stop the first outward-bound train that passes by here after dark," Pitt answered, "and borrow it."
"Trains have communication systems," said Pembroke Smythe. "The engineer will scream bloody murder if you attempt to abscond with his train."
"Once alerted, the Malians will block the track down the line," finished the Swedish officer.
"Don't give it another thought," Pitt said reproachfully. "Just leave it to old Jesse James Pitt and Butch Cassidy Giardino. We've been practicing the old-fashioned art of silent train hijacking for at least..." He looked at Giardino.
"Al?"
"At least a week from last Thursday," Giardino responded.
Pembroke Smythe looked at Levant forlornly. "One might be advised to increase our insurance premiums."
"Too late for that now," said Levant, surveying the darkened interior of the fort. "These walls were never built to stand against air-to-ground missiles or heavy artillery. Kazim's forces can reduce this place to rubble in half an hour, so to prevent problems we have to maintain its abandoned look."
"The Malians won't be going up against helpless civilians this time," Pembroke Smythe said resolutely. "The ground is level as a cricket field for 2 kilometers in every direction. No cover for attacking forces. Those of us who survive any air assault will make Kazim pay a heavy price in blood before he takes this place."
"You better hope he hasn't any tanks in the area," Giardino reminded him.
"Post lookouts on the ramparts," Levant ordered.
"Then search for an opening leading below ground. As I recall, during my visit there was an arsenal to store shells and ammunition."
As Levant suggested, steps leading underground were quickly found beneath a floor in the barracks. The two small rooms below were empty, except for a few open metal boxes that once held clips of rifle cartridges. The captives of Tabeza were quickly unloaded and assisted below.
thankful to be out of the personnel vehicles and on firm earth again. The medical team made them as comfortable as possible and tended to those in serious condition. The tactical team's vehicles were soon hidden and covered over to look like piles of debris. By the time the sun threw its heat against the walls, the old Foreign Legion fort had regained its abandoned appearance. The two overriding dilemmas facing Levant were discovery before nightfall and the vulnerability to air attack. He felt little sense of security. Once caught, there was no place to run. Already the guards on the ramparts wistfully watched a train leave the waste project for the Mauritania coast, grimly longing to be on it. Pitt surveyed what had been a motor pool with a collapsed roof. He inspected a dozen steel drums of diesel fuel half buried under a pile of old trash. He tapped the metal containers and found six of them nearly full. He was in the act of unscrewing the spout caps as Giordino strolled under the shelter. "Planning on making a fire?" he asked. "Might not be a bad idea if we're hit by armored vehicles," said Pitt. "The UN troops lost their anti-tank missile launchers when their aircraft blew up." "Diesel fuel," mused Giordino, "must have been stored here by the construction crew that laid the railroad." Pitt probed a finger through the spout opening and then held it up. "As pure as the day it came out of the refinery." "What good is it except for Molotov cocktails?" Giordino asked with a dubious expression. "Unless you want to boil it and play Knights of Old by pouring it on the enemy when they scale the walls." "You're getting warm." Giordino grimaced at the pun. "Five men and a small boy couldn't lift one of those drums and carry it to the walls, not when it's full to the gills." "Ever see a torsion spring bow?" "Not in my lifetime," Giordino grunted. "Will I sound stupid if I ask you to draw a picture?" To Giordino's surprise, Pitt did just that. He hunched down, pulled a double-edged commando knife from a leg sheath, and began sketching a diagram in the dust on the floor. The design was rough, but Giordino recognized what Pitt was attempting to project. When Pitt was finished, he looked up. "Think we can build one?" "Don't see why not," said Giordino. "Plenty of beams in the fort to choose from, and the personnel vehicles carry lengths of nylon line for rock climbing and emergency towing. The catch, as I see it, is we'll need something to provide torsion." "The leaf springs on the rear axles?" Giordino pondered a moment, then nodded. "They might work." "Yes, by God, they should work perfectly." "Probably a waste of time," said Pitt, studying his drawing. "No reason to think one of Kazim's patrols will stumble in here and blow the whistle before train time. 11 hours until dark, it will give us something to keep us occupied." Pitt began moving toward the door. "You start assembling the parts. I've got an errand to run. I'll catch up to you later." Pitt walked past a group of men who were strengthening the doors of the main gate and made his way around the walls of the fort, careful to cover his footprints. He dropped down into a narrow ravine and walked until he came to a mound rising beside a steep slope. The Avion Voisin sat in undisturbed solitude. Most of the sand he and Giordino had hastily thrown over the roof and hood had blown away, but enough was left to have kept it difficult to spot by Kazim's air patrols. He opened the door, sat behind the wheel, and pressed the starter button. Almost at once the engine settled into a quiet idle. Pitt sat there for a few minutes, admiring the workmanship of the old auto. Then he turned off the ignition switch, stepped out, and recovered the body with sand. Pitt climbed down the stairs into the arsenal. He saw immediately that Eva was on the mend. Although she was still haggard and pale, and her clothing tattered and filthy, she was helping to feed a young boy who was cradled in his mother's arms. She looked up at Pitt with an expression that reflected renewed strength and determination. "How is he doing?" he asked. "He'll be playing soccer in no time after he's eaten some solid food and a healthy supply of vitamins." "I play football," the boy whispered. "In France?" Eva asked curiously. "We call it soccer," said Pitt, smiling. "In every country but ours it's known as football." The father of the boy, one of the French engineers who had constructed the Fort Fourreau project, came over and shook Pitt's hand. He looked like a scarecrow. He wore crude leather sandals, his shirt was torn and stained, and his pants were held up by a knotted rope. His face was half hidden under a black beard, and one side of his head was heavily bandaged.
I am Louis Monteur.
Dirk Pitt.
On behalf of my wife and boy, Monteur said weakly, I can't thank you enough for saving our lives.
We're not out of Mali yet, said Pitt.
Better a quick death than Tabeza.
By this time tomorrow we'll be beyond General Kazim's reach, Pitt assured him.
Kazim and Yves Massard, Monteur spat, murdering criminals of the first magnitude.
The reason Massard sent you and your family to Tabeza, Pitt questioned him, it was to keep you from exposing the fraudulent operation at Fort Fourreau?
Yes.
The team of scientists and engineers who originally designed and constructed the project discovered upon completion that Massard planned to bring in far more toxic waste than the operation was capable of disposing.
What was your job?
To design and oversee the construction of the thermal reactor for the destruction of the waste.
And it's working.
Monteur nodded proudly.
Yes, indeed.
Extremely well. It happens to be the largest and most efficient detoxification system operating anywhere in the world today. The solar energy technology of Fort Fourreau is the finest in its field.
So where did Massard go wrong?
Why spend hundreds of millions of dollars for state-of-the-art equipment only to use it as a facade to secretly bury nuclear and excessive trainloads of toxic waste?
Germany, Russia, China, the United States, half the world is awash in high-level nuclear waste. The violently radioactive sludge that remains from reprocessed reactor fuel rods and the fissionable material from the production of nuclear bombs. Though it only represents less than 1% of all leftover nuclear material, there are still millions of gallons of it sitting around with nowhere to go. Massard offered to dispose of it all.
But some governments have built disposal repositories.
Too little, too late, Monteur shrugged. France's new burial site at Sulaine was almost filled when completed.
Then there is the Hanford Reservation waste facility at Richland, Washington, in your country. The tanks that were designed to contain high-level liquid waste for half a century began leaking after 20 years. Close to 1 million gallons of highly radioactive waste have escaped into the ground to contaminate the groundwater.
A neat setup, said Pitt thoughtfully.
Massard makes under-the-table deals with governments and corporations desperate to get rid of their toxic waste. Because Fort Fourreau in the Western Sahara seemed an ideal dumping ground, he goes into partnership with Zateb Kazim as a buffer against domestic or foreign protest. Then he charges exorbitant fees and smuggles the waste into the middle of the world's most useless piece of real estate and buries it under the guise of a thermal detoxification center.
A simple but reasonably accurate description.
But how do you know all this?
My friend and I penetrated the underground storage chamber and saw the nuclear waste containers.
Dr. Hopper told us you were captured at the project.
In your opinion, Mr. Monteur, could Massard have built a beneficial and reliable project at Fort Fourreau to dispose of all the waste that comes in?
Absolutely, Monteur said decisively. If Massard had excavated waste storage chambers 2 kilometers deep in stable rock formations immune to seismic activity, he would have been raised to sainthood. But he is a miserly, ruthless businessman interested only in profit and gain. Massard is a sick man addicted to power and money that he siphons to a secret hoard somewhere.
Did you know that it was chemical waste that leaked into the underground water? Pitt asked.
A chemical?
My understanding is that the compound responsible for thousands of deaths throughout this section of the desert is made up from a synthetic amino acid and cobalt.
We heard nothing after we arrived at Tabeza, said Monteur.
He visibly shuddered.
God, it's already become more horrible than I ever imagined. But the worst has yet to come. Massard has used inferior canisters to store the nuclear and toxic wastes. It is only a question of time before the whole storage chamber and the land for miles around is swimming in liquid death.
Something else you don't know, said Pitt.
The compound is seeping through underground streams to the Niger River, where it is carried downstream into the ocean. There it is causing an explosion of the red tides that is consuming all life and oxygen in the water.
Monteur rubbed his face with his hands in saddened shock at the news.
What have we done?
If we'd only known that Massard was out to build a cheap and dangerous operation, none of us would have allowed it.
Pitt looked at Monteux. You must have figured Massard's scheme early in the construction.
Massard shook his head. Those of us imprisoned in Tabeza were all outside consultants and contractors. We were only involved in the design and construction of the photovoltaic array and thermal reactor. We paid little attention to the excavation. That was an altogether separate project under Massard Enterprises.
When did your suspicions become aroused?
Not at first. If anyone questioned Massard's workers out of simple curiosity, they were told that the excavation was for temporary storage of incoming waste before detoxification. No one was allowed near the area except the underground construction crew. Only near completion of the project did we begin to see through the lie.
What finally gave Massard away? Asked Pitt.
We all assumed the underground storage chamber was fully completed about the time the thermal reactor was successfully tested for full operation. At that point, the toxic materials began arriving on the railroad Massard had built with cheap labor provided by General Kazim. One evening, an engineer, who had been assembling the parabolic solar collectors, slipped into the storage chamber by stealing an entry badge. He discovered the digging had never ceased and was an ongoing project after he saw excavated dirt being secretly shipped out into cargo containers that carried in the toxic waste. He also found caverns holding canisters filled with nuclear waste.
Pitt nodded. My friend and I stumbled on those secrets too, unaware we were on Massard's security video show.
The engineer escaped back to our living quarters and spread the word before he could be stopped, Monteux explained. Shortly after, all of us who were non-Massard Enterprises consultants and our families were forcibly rounded up and sent to Tabeza to keep the secret from getting back to France.
How did he cover up your sudden disappearance?
A phony story about a disaster at the project, a fire that killed us all. The French government insisted on a full inquiry, but Kazim refused to allow foreign inspectors into Mali, claiming his government would conduct the investigation. Of course, none took place, and our supposed cremated bodies were reported as scattered over the desert after a proper ceremony.
The green in Pitt's eyes deepened.
Massard is a thorough man. But he made a series of mistakes.
Mistakes? Monteux said curiously.
He let too many people live.
When you were captured, did you meet him?
Pitt raised his hand and touched one of the scabs that cut across his cheeks.
He also has a nasty disposition.
Monteux smiled. Consider yourself lucky that is your only gift from him. When we were assembled and given our death sentence as slave labor in the mines, one woman resisted and spat in Massard's face. He calmly shot her between the eyes right in front of her husband and 10-year-old daughter.
The more I hear about the man, Pitt said, his tone cold, the less he endears himself to me.
The commandos say we will attempt to capture a train and then escape into Mauritania tonight.
Pitt nodded.
That's the plan if we're not discovered by Malian military forces before dark.
We have talked between ourselves, said Monteux solemnly. None will go back to Tabeza. All would rather die. We have made a pact to kill our wives and children rather than allow them to suffer in the mines again.
Pitt stared at Monteux and then at the women and children resting on the stone floor of the arsenal. His craggy and weathered face took on a look of sorrow tinged with anger. Then he said softly, "Let's hope it doesn't come to that." Eva was too tired to sleep. She looked up into Pitt's eyes.
A walk under the morning sun with me?
Eva was too tired to sleep. She looked up into Pitt's eyes.
A walk under the morning sun with me?
No one is allowed to wander in the open. The fort has to appear abandoned to passing trains and any aircraft that might fly over.
We traveled all last night, and I've been locked up underground for nearly 2 weeks. Isn't there some way I can see the sun? She implored him.
He said nothing but gave her his best buccaneer grin as he swept her in his arms and carried her up the stairs onto the parade ground. Not stopping, he climbed to the platform that stretched around the fort's ramparts before lightly setting her on her feet.
The sun blinded Eva for a few moments, and she didn't see the approach of a female commando who was on duty as a lookout. "You must stay below out of sight," the guard ordered. "Colonel Avant's orders." "A couple of minutes," Pitt pleaded. "The lady hasn't seen blue sky for quite a while." The tactical team fighter may have looked tough as nails in her combat suit, bristling with ammo and weapons, but she possessed twice the compassion and understanding of any man. One look at the wasted woman leaning against Pitt and her expression softened. 2 minutes, she smiled ever so slightly. "Then you'll have to get back undercover." "Thank you," said Eva. "I'm very grateful to you." The scorching temperatures were still an hour away as Pitt and Eva looked out from their vantage point across the nearby railroad tracks toward the endless, unbroken terrain to the north. Strangely, it was Pitt and not the woman who saw a magnificence in the parched and hostile landscape, despite the fact that it had almost killed him. "I can't wait to see the ocean again," she said. "Do you dive?" he asked. "I've always loved water, but never got beyond the snorkel stage." "Varied sea life abounds around Monterey. Beautiful fish among the kelp forests, and incredible rock formations, especially down the coast past Carmel toward Big Sur. When we get there, I'll give you scuba lessons and take you diving." "I look forward to it." She closed her eyes, tilted back her head, and soaked in the sun, her cheeks glowing from the rising heat of the day. He gazed down at her, taking in every lovely detail that had not been affected by her long ordeal. The lookouts, stationed around the ramparts, faded into the bright sunlight. He wanted to wrap her in his arms, forget the dangers, forget everything but this moment, and kiss her. And he did. For a long moment, she gripped him tightly around the neck and kissed back. He squeezed her around the waist and pulled her to her toes. How long they clung together, neither could remember. Finally, she pushed back and looked up into his opaline green eyes and felt weakness, excitement, and love wrapped up in one swirling emotion. She whispered, "I knew from that dinner together in Cairo I'd never be able to resist you." He said softly, "And I thought I'd never see you again. Will you be going back to Washington after we escape?" She spoke the words as if reaching safety was a certainty. He shrugged without letting her go. "I'm sure they'll want me to return and work on stopping the red tides. And you, after a good rest, where will it be? Another mission of mercy to an underdeveloped country to fight disease?" "It's my job," she murmured. "Helping to save lives is all I've ever wanted to do since I was a little girl." "Doesn't leave much time for romance, does it?" "We're both prisoners of our occupations." The lookout came over then. "You'll have to get down below out of sight now," she said, as if embarrassed. "We can't be too careful now, can we?" Eva pulled Pitt's beard stubbly face down to hers and whispered again in his ear. "Would you think me wanton if I said I want you?" He smiled. "I'm an easy mark for wanton girls." She made a small gesture at brushing back her hair and straightening out her dirty and tattered clothing. "But certainly not one who hasn't bathed in 2 weeks and is as skinny as an underfed alley cat." "Oh, I don't know. Unwashed, skinny women have been known to bring out the animal in me." Without another word, Pitt led her down to the parade ground and into a small storeroom off of what was once the kitchen and mess hall. It was empty except for a wooden keg of iron spikes. No one was in sight. He left her for a minute and returned with 2 blankets. Then he laid the blankets on the dusty floor of the empty storeroom and locked the door. They could barely see each other from the light that crept under the door as he squeezed her with his arms again. "Sorry, I can't offer you champagne and a king-size bed." Eva daintily straightened the blankets and knelt down, looking up at his dim, rugged-looking face. "I'll just close my eyes and imagine I'm with my handsome lover in the most luxurious suite in the finest hotel in San Francisco." Pitt kissed her and laughed softly. "Lady, you've got one fantastic imagination."